post-World War II. Don't Walk on the Grass Conformity on the campus of the University of Illinois. Today's report is produced by Una High student Gloria Ha and is voiced by Linus Urbach.
The University of Illinois was no exception to the blind conformity of the 1950s and 60s, with an enormous system of fraternities and sororities dictating rules of student behavior. Howard Schein, a graduate student in the 60s, recalls what it was like.
When I first came here in 1966, there were a lot of rules of conduct that were implicit, not rules, but like, I'll give you an example. You didn't walk on the quad. You walked only on the sidewalks. A true Illini never cuts. That was like everybody. You did not walk on the grass. And if you wanted to eat lunch sitting on the grass, you sat way on the edge so that nobody would kick you off.
Penny Hanna arrived on campus in 1967 and remembers experiencing culture shock.
So in writing, we had read an essay by George Orwell where he talked about how you could understand the psychology and the nature of a character of a nation by how they walked. So when I would walk on the quad, I would see these people walking on these lines and crisscrossing when you had this huge, beautiful green space and nobody stepped off the sidewalk. I wrote an essay about how that looked strange to me because why walk in these little narrow paths, everybody at the same pace in the same lines going the same way and nobody walking on the grass. And that the shock was, why are they staying within the lines? I don't get it.
For newcomers to the University of Illinois, this adherence to Greek system rules was both bewildering and concerning. Renee Pollock, who came to the University of Illinois in 1968, remembers the Greek rush in which new students joined fraternities and sororities.
I remember standing on a corner and watching everybody march from house to house, which is how rush is done. I couldn't understand why anybody would be interested in doing that at that point in time when there were all these crucial world issues going on. Like, why would it be that you just wanted to live in a house with a bunch of girls and, like, have pillow fights when people were going off to die? You know, I couldn't figure that out. So it was an interesting period of time.
As additional students questioned conformity and the status quo, counterculture was manifested at the University of Illinois by those who stepped outside of the lines and ventured into the greens of revolution.
For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. 'Cause the battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
That's University Laboratory High School sophomore Linus Urbach speaking on behalf of student reporter Gloria Ha. Listen to the Uni High and Illinois Public Media documentary, Beyond the Tie-Dye, Counterculture in Champaign-Urbana, 1965-75, this Saturday at 6 p.m. here on WILL AM 580. Detroit is preparing for a huge corruption trial. Former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, who once described himself as the first hip-hop mayor, faces federal charges that he used the city government to operate a widespread criminal enterprise. Quinn Kleinfelder of member station WDET reports.
In 2008, then-Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick was under attack. Embroiled in a scandal over racy text messages to his mistress, his family pursued for interviews by what he labeled a white racist media, and at the end of a televised State of the City address, before a hand-picked crowd of supporters, Kilpatrick fired back at his critics.
We've never been in a situation like this before, where you can say anything, do anything, have no facts, no research, no nothing, and you can launch a hate-driven, bigoted assault on a family.
6 months later, a far more subdued Kilpatrick resigned from office and admitted to a judge he'd lied about the text messages during a deposition.
I lied under oath in the case of Gary Brown and Harold Nelter versus the City of Detroit. I did so with the intent to mislead the court and the jury and to impede and obstruct the fair administration of justice.
He was sentenced to 4 months in jail and $1 million restitution. But while on probation, a judge found him guilty of hiding assets and sentenced him to 14 months of prison time. In 2010, the federal government dramatically raised the stakes. Kilpatrick and three others were indicted for a different crime, 38 federal counts, including racketeering, bribery, and tax evasion. U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid said that Kilpatrick ran city government like an organized crime family, shaking down city contractors for bribes.
From what I've seen, it was a way of doing business in the Kilpatrick administration. City contracts are an opportunity for us to make money.
Kilpatrick, once embraced by Democratic Party insiders as a rising political star, has long been a polarizing figure in Detroit. At age 31, he was the youngest mayor ever elected in the city. He cultivated a brash image while installing friends and family in key government positions. Now some of those friends are witnesses in the federal corruption trial against him.
It's not so much the law that's interesting, but, you know, there are some of the elements of the classic Greek tragedy.
Former federal prosecutor and Wayne State University law professor Peter Henning says the government's case hinges on wiretaps, the infamous text messages, and testimony from some of Kilpatrick's childhood friends who worked in his administration.
These are his buddies who have now turned on him. And that's where prosecutors have to be careful, because a witness can equivocate. Might that send a message to a jury that, well, maybe there's just not enough evidence here?
Kilpatrick and his family moved to a Dallas suburb in 2008, but he met weeks ago with the Detroit chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists and told them he welcomes a chance to clear his name in federal court.
So many people in Detroit say, Kwame stole money. I have never stole a damn dime in my life from anybody. And I'm not even charged with that, oddly. You know, that just became kind of like community folklore. Because if you hear every day somebody's a criminal crook thug, you know, you kind of just go with it.
A federal jury will likely be seated this week to determine whether the flamboyant former mayor is indeed a crook in a trial that could last 4 months. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Gas prices are on the rise again. Since the beginning of July, the average price for a regular gallon of gasoline in the U.S. has gone up 50 cents, which makes the national average just under $3.90 a gallon. NPR's Jeff Brady has good news, though. Prices are likely to go down soon.
Americans tend to drive more in the summer, and higher demand for gas usually sends prices up. But Tom Kloza, chief oil analyst with the Oil Price Information Service, says this year it looks like drivers put off their summer trips.
Unlike other summers where perhaps the driving was front-end loaded, this year was a little bit back-end loaded, and there was a lot more vacation travel towards the end of August and in the week after Labor Day.
So April through July this year, prices actually declined. Over the past 2 months, they've been going back up.
I think the good news is that we are peaking again, and we should see lower prices in the last 100 days of the year, as is typical for most years.
Kloza says don't expect lower prices right away, but he suspects that by November, prices may fall to around $3.50 a gallon. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
It's the season for harvesting apples, but this year in Michigan, they're really hard to find. Only about 15% of the state's normal crop survived freezing temperatures in April.
I always say we're 2 degrees from disaster most springs, and this year it caught up with us.
The story of Michigan's missing apples, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 17th of September, 2012. It was on this date in 1683, a Dutchman named Antoni van Leeuwenhoek wrote a letter to the Royal Society in Amsterdam, sharing his discovery of what he called animalcules, or what we know as bacterium. He had no higher education, but he was very curious about the world around him. He had been experimenting with grinding lenses and making his own simple microscopes, and he studied the plaque that he found between his teeth, and he saw, he said, very little living animalcules, very prettily a-moving. The biggest sword had a very strong and swift motion and shot through the water or spit like a pike does through the water. The second sort spun round like a top and were far more in number. He was one of the first to observe bacteria. The Royal Society was skeptical. They wondered if he was crazy, but today Leeuwenhoek is considered the father of microbiology. He looked at blood cells, sperm, nematodes, muscle fibers, and algae. He wrote right up until his death at the age of 90, and his last letters were very detailed observations of his own final illness. It's the birthday of the man who wrote one of the best-known and oft-parodied poems, his poem, "I Have Eaten the Plums That Were in the Icebox and Which You Were Probably Saving for Breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold." William Carlos Williams, born Rutherford, New Jersey, 1883, doctor and poet. William Carlos Williams, who wrote, "It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there." He said, "We are blind and live our blind lives out in blindness. Poets are damned, but they are not blind. They see with the eyes of angels." It's the birthday of the Irish writer Frank O'Connor, born Michael O'Donovan in Cork in 1903. He worked as a librarian, self-educated, thought about becoming a painter, but paints cost too much money, so he became a writer because, he said, you could be a writer with a pencil and a penny notebook. His stories collected in the book The Stories of Frank O'Connor, and he wrote two memoirs, An Only Child and My Father's Son. And it's the birthday of Ken Kesey, born in La Junta, Colorado, 1935, champion wrestler in high school, voted most likely to succeed, got a fellowship in creative writing at Stanford. He became an aide in the VA hospital, where he heard about an experiment in search of volunteers, and he volunteered. It was run by the CIA. They were investigating various mind control techniques, injecting people with mescaline or LSD. So he took the drugs and the experiment, and they gave him the idea for his first novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, a struggle between a powerful nurse and a con man named Randall Patrick McMurphy. Here's a poem by William Carlos Williams on his birthday, his poem The Red Wheelbarrow. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. The Red Wheelbarrow, poem by William Carlos Williams from his collected poems published by New Directions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, helping business